This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we're here to talk about in this episode include...
Gear Ups.
James Willing's River Pirates.
Gar Hanrahan on Marishire Detective Club.
And a Chinese Nostradamus?
Big news from Mission Control. If you missed out the first time, don't panic. The wait is over. The Catstronauts board game is finally back in stock at Atlas Games.
That's right. Catstronauts sold out almost immediately on release, but the reprint has officially landed. Now you can finally bring the kitty crew home to your tabletop.
And just in time, too, because things are getting interesting on the International Space Station.
Giant laser pointers in space and a live stream of nose boops? What's not to like? Let's check out how the Catstronauts are doing up there.
Oh man, there goes Waffles the pilot. He's off to see how many kibble bits can achieve orbit around his belly. A pioneer in snackodynamics, that cat.
Careful, Waffles. If the other Catstronauts catch you clogging the air filters with crumbs again, it's back to litter box duty for you.
Look at them working together. Waffles is keeping the station steady, Pom Pom is swatting at fasteners like feather toys, and Major Meowser is... napping on the instructions.
Teamwork at its finest. You can lead this kitty crew yourself in the official Catstronauts board game.
It's a cooperative challenge featuring pawsome art by the comics creator Drew Brockington, and it's perfect for gamers of all ages.
But remember, the first printing disappeared at light speed. Don't let this reprint of Catstronauts slip through your claws.
Secure your copy today at atlas-games.com/catstronauts. That's atlas-games.com/catstronauts. The rattle of dice, the thump of miniatures, the crunch of Doritos, and the wind sweeping across the battlements of Elsinore welcome us once more into the gaming hut that happens behind, or I guess in front of, also, Hamlet's GM screen. Peter Frampton is somewhere with us in spirit. Maybe he's fled to Fife after a series of unexplained murders. Who can say? But we are here, and with all these unexplained murders, Robin, and with our missing beloved Peter Frampton, I think it's time we gear up. We get some goods. We get some weapons. We get some, maybe some skills. We have a montage. What do you think?
Yeah, possibly we hire somebody to train us if we're playing RuneQuest.
Right.
So Hamlet's GM screen, of course, is my new book, which takes the beat analysis system originally debuted in Hamlet's Hit Points and applies it directly to moments that we experience at the gaming table. And this time around, I thought that we would talk about a phase of a scenario that occurs in certain genres, specifically the fantasy genre, not just F20. I already mentioned RuneQuest.
Right.
It's sort of a kind of an older assumption, but I bet there's a whole lot of people that really dig it. And I think this is, and I'm calling this the gear up. And so what I'm referring to is the chunk of time that you spend in town before you head to a dungeon or other adventure, and you know you're going there and you got a bunch of prep to do. And the GM says, okay, what do you do before you leave town? And I think this is worth looking at in terms of beat analysis, because this is an example of something where different people at the table respond to each in their own way, because some people, this is their bag, right? It's not a fun session unless you get to talk to a shopkeeper and unless you get to, you know, decide what potion to take with you and carefully choose up all your spells. And for other people, they're going to zone out during this, that this is not their thing. They would just as soon have you cut to arriving at the dungeon, which you might well do if everybody in your group feels that way and they want to steal the preparedness rules from Gumshoe in order to have stuff with them. That's fine. You're golden. You've solved that problem. But if some people love this and some people don't, the trick of paying attention at the table to who's engaged with what and keeping everybody happy, both with suspense beats if they need those or to enjoy a nice little relaxing, you know, toe in the water of adventure before you put yourself in danger. That's what we're going to look at now. And not only is it something in which people are sort of siloed, but it's something that proceeds at the pace of the slowest player. So it can be a real challenge. But Ken, as I've already heard you chuckling in agreement, this is something that some people love and really expect and will feel cheated if they don't get it.
Yeah. And also, given the constraints of old school dungeoning, it's a necessary process unless you, as you say, import preparedness. Part of the tactical fun of going into a dungeon is, how many 10-foot poles do I need? Did I bring enough oil flasks? Should I get high soft boots for sneaking or high hard boots for kicking? These are all decisions that you make ahead of time to kit yourself out. In Knights Black Agents, I tried to sort of add the Jason Bourne finds his cache of stuff level of elevation in terms of tone or tension to it. But it's the same thing. It's like, we're going after the vampire. What do we know about the vampire? Should we bring garlic? Should we bring holy water? Do we have a super soaker? Will it work? Will we look like idiots? You know, the gear up is an important part of not just F20, but in a lot of sort of modern day heist or espionage type movies, there's occasionally the mandatory gear up session. And in Supernatural, you know, they're sort of assumed to have stuff in the back of their trunk, but opening the trunk and going through it is still an important part of Supernatural. So you can even ease it into horror and monster hunting as well. So gear up is not just for F20, but it is a big part of F20. And that's kind of why you should have a method of doing it, even if, as you say, it's just, oh, we're going to use preparedness. You'll roll your wisdom to make sure you brought stuff. And then as the characters use that as their dump stat, start crying, you say, or your intelligence, fine.
Right.
And then the fighter just better hope he only needs a sword.
So the first step to making this fun, if it is required by your game and by the desires of your players, is to understand what people like about it. So first of all, there's an aesthetic appeal of owning imaginary things.
Yes.
I particularly enjoy owning imaginary things because I don't have to figure out where to store them in my apartment. And so,
easier to do the paperwork for my imaginary Tech 9.
Yeah, exactly. You're playing the role of someone who has a bunch of extra stuff. Also, if you are going out and shopping, that means you are exercising choices. You're going out and deciding, you know, as you suggested, which kind of boot do I want? How many poles do I want? So you are, as a player, you're making choices. You're deciding things. And that is intrinsic to the game, as you suggest.
And they're choices that pay off immediately and in the way you meant most often.
Exactly. If you go and buy boots, you get the boots, right? Unless something particularly weird happens. Also, the fact that it is sort of a leisurely player-controlled pacing is a positive for a lot of people. Like the casual player who doesn't want things to be too tense, or somebody who wants to kind of ease into it and they're not looking to have tension ratcheted up all the time. It's a whole bunch of possible gratification beats all at the beginning. Ideally, according to beat analysis, you want to, you know, alternate them a bit. But, you know, they're storing up a bunch of relaxation that can will all go to heck when they get to the safe house or the ghoul crypt. Also, I think that people who love talking to shopkeepers enjoy that because it's no stakes role playing, right? That they can just have a fun little conversation and imagine their character. And it's not life or death. It's not about whether you're going to get the information you need or whether the king's going to throw you in the dungeon. It's literally the chance just to sort of have a fun ramble. So in that sense, those scenes almost kind of focus on, not on dramatic beats, as you might expect, because there's no drama. You don't want anything really emotionally from the shopkeeper, except, you know, possibly that cool new pair of boots you're looking at. But it's more of a gratification beat. It's a chance to have a nice, fun interaction. Some players, on the other hand, do want to add a little bit of social combat to this sequence.
They love to haggle.
Yeah, the haggling. And these may be the players who would otherwise be bored by this and are doing you the favor of coming up with the thing that makes it fun for them. And possibly
at the slight cost of making everything taste 15 times longer.
Yes. If you're 13-year-old starting out with your first dungeon, maybe one of the players decides to spend the whole episode trying to rip off the magic store. Everybody's had that happen, and it's fun once. So that can basically tack a whole different adventure onto the adventure, which works in a lot of fantasy games that are kind of sandboxy.
And we have to buy gear for our heist of the magic store.
Yes, exactly. and it is weird that the magic store and the heist of the magic store gear shop are right next to each other.
They're run by the same dwarf.
Yeah, it's all part of a big scam. Yeah, he sells you the heist equipment, and then you get there, and there's nothing in his vault. Other players may just want to sort of go around exploring their city environment or the village or seeing, you know, I've got all my stuff. Let me see where the nearest bar is with a portal to the realms of the Fae, and let me see what's up with that. So this also gives an opportunity to people who like to sort of poke around an environment in a low stakes way to go and do that. And if you sense that that's exactly what they want, just to noodle around and see some stuff and not have a lot of tension, you can deliver just, you know, cool detail. And if you think that they might want a little mini adventure at the top, you can do that, with the proviso that, you know, the more you do to elaborate the gear up, the more time the gear up is going to take. And the chances are that you're not going to get to the dungeon this session. So one thing to be aware of, though, especially when it comes to timing, is gratification remorse, is that in a way that you sometimes see with what people enjoy in, say, films, for example, and then profess not to enjoy when they think about it later. Gratification remorse in role-playing games is a real thing, where somebody asks for something, you give it to them, and then they wish they hadn't got it because they didn't actually want it at all, which, as metaphors for the human condition go, that's great. But at the gaming table, you do have to ask yourself, it's like, well, you know, Josephine says she wants a totally sandbox session, but actually she gets bored and itchy when that happens. Let's guide her experience a little more and let her, you know, give her just a little taste of noodling around the city environment and then get going as soon as you can.
There's a fun rule in Swords of the Serpentine, and this occurs to me because we kind of basically just did this. It was not quite the gear up. It's more the traveler. You're at the new starport. You're meeting the guy who's going to buy your cargo. They're in Monomvasia in Greece, meeting the guys who are going to buy their cargo. And in Swords, there's a rule that says if you carouse, meaning if you spend a, you know, arbitrary period, like a night, not doing anything productive, you get 5 refresh tokens. And so normally my punishment, but my special sauce for the carouse bonus is that carousing always turns up a plot hook. And the last time they caroused for points, they got also tangled up in the plot hooks, and they wound up feeling that perhaps they'd been cheated a bit of their carousal money because they had to spend all those chips, you know, dealing with the plot hook. This time, they resolutely ignored the plot hooks, which I think was very, very heroic of them. But it also...
Yeah, plot hooks. Those plot hooks are expensive. I wish I could afford a plot hook like that.
Right. Looks like that guy's going to get beaten up, or he's going to eat people. We don't know, but not my business. Going to stay here in the bar and drink. But that provides a sort of a pointer, I think, to doing things in the gearing up session that you can either set up a future adventure. The dwarf who runs the magic shop is going to turn out to have a brother who needs help or whatever, or you successfully heist the magic shop and now blowback is going to happen because the Mage's Guild is going to get on your neck or whatever. But use these scenes not just to do the low stakes fun, but also prevent seeds of high stakes fun for players who are looking for that and get energized by either plot or at least by exploring the setting and saying, okay, now I know who the main players in this Greek port city are. And if we need to do anything here again, or if we need to do anything later on in the adventure, we'll have a sense of what the social backdrop is. And if we need to Yojimbo, the town of Monomvasia, we now know who to do it with.
Yeah. If you want to keep it low stakes and still tie it into the adventure, of course, there's the classic gear up as pipe beat, where you establish something that will matter later, whether it's, you know, meeting the guy at the docks who you'll need to talk to, or literally a piece of gear that matters. You go into the shopkeeper and says, oh, I had a vision last night, and I sense that you would need the everlasting rope. And because I owe a duty to my God, whenever I see a vision, I will sell you the everlasting rope at 15% off. Right. And then Now, that could just be a funny thing, but we all know how stories work, that really this guy is acting as the fantasy version of Q, and they now get to go, oh, there's an everlasting rope. They can have an anticipation beat for when the rope will come up, and they'll feel twice as smart for figuring out how to use that when it gets to the special encounter that you've designed around that whole thing. Other ways to sort of tame the gear up and keep it within everybody's mutual tolerance is to put a little time limit on it, is that, you know, okay, well, we got five players. Everybody's going to get 3 minutes of spotlight time to do this. And then the rest of it, just let's do that as sort of side activity in the Slack or Discord, and we'll forge along, but you can still continue to just do the, you know, the straight up buying stuff that doesn't require, you know, talking to the vendor or whatever. We've already also touched on, you know, if you make an interaction with a vendor funny, that will be enjoyable for everybody else who's sitting there and listening to the person who likes to talk with the vendor. So, you know, it'll be entertaining for that person and for everybody else. Interweave scenes. If somebody doesn't need to decide what potions to take or to get new boots, give them a little bit of character interaction, some dramatic scenes with somebody they care about, or have them go learn something, find out something that that character likes to do that defines them, that doesn't add a whole lot of plot, but gives them a little character moment. And then finally, if you have this problem on a routine basis and you can possibly swing it, try and pace your scenario so that it's when they come back from the dungeon at the end of the session, that's when you get your 15 minutes of prep time for the next session. And that way, if it's sort of winding down and you're moving into sort of bookkeeping mode, the players who are impatient with it are already sort of packing up their stuff and ready to go. And it's not as much of a pacing issue to introduce a big bunch of, you know, basically logistical stuff at the beginning because you've stuck it at the end.
Well, now that we are moving the shopping to the end, perhaps we have moved it to the end of this entire hut, and we gaze out from this end of the hut across the beautiful fields of a wonderful commercial and into another hut across those fields. In a hole in the ground, they found a body.
I know! Here we are in Marysher, right in the middle of the beautiful bucolic riding.
So bucolic.
With its neat hedgerows, and picturesque taverns, and delightful crumpet shops, and quaint little village greens.
Yeah, can we go back to the crumpets?
Yes, so what did you want to know about them?
I wanted to have some crumpets and shut off the recording.
Okay, let's do that.
Okay, we're back. What were we saying?
Murder!
Murder?
Yes, we've got murder to solve.
In the bucolic riding? Where all the halflings live?
Yes, the halflings. Plus also some boggarts, pukas, and dwarves. But weren't we concerned about something?
Murder?
Yes, murder! Another case in need of sleuthing by a team of amateur detectives.
It would be unthinkable if this wasn't the third murder this week.
Marysher Detective Club is a fantasy mystery-solving RPG.
By the master of fantasy and mystery.
And fantasy mystery.
Gareth Ryder Hanrahan.
Investigate crimes, question eccentric neighbors, stop for tea and cakes, unravel puzzles, and get involved in pedantic arguments about jam.
Wait, what kind of jam?
In the most adorable,
but still murdery,
gumshoe game yet, you gather clues, uncover motives, follow gossip, question suspicious neighbors, stop for lunch, get sidetracked. Remember, you're supposed to be solving a case. Gather some more clues. Question more eccentric locals.
Possibly chase a swan or something.
And slowly piece together the truth.
Now on Backer Kit from Pelgrane Press.
Type Backer Kit and Marysher into your favorite search engine to find the campaign page. The sounds of pipers piping, the martial drums, and I think some cannons going off in the background tell us that we're once more in the History Hut, but it's a particularly Revolutionary War version of the History Hut because we've been thinking about Flagbearer Games Nation and Cannons and their upcoming American Crisis Dark and Bloody Grand Kickstarter. And to get people all in the mood for that when that starts, we've been thinking of huts we can do. So this is a History Hut. And in this History Hut, we are going to think about James Willing, a some say incompetent river pirate, but I say, you know, when you engage in river piracy, you never know how it's going to go. Things might not work out, but maybe it's about the river pirates you meet along the way. So tell us all about James Willing and why he was willing to get up to river piracy.
Well, first of all, I think it was the river pirates he met along the way that did all the pirating. James Willing was a commissioned officer in the Continental Navy. He was fighting the hated British with whom we were at war. Virtually everything he did could be broadly classed as actions in the time of war, and therefore not piracy.
Now, river warfare.
As you allude, there are river pirates who say, oh, people are looting stuff. We like looting. Let's go. So, and did he like control those river pirates? He did not. So anyway, James Willing is born to a prosperous Philadelphia merchant family, 1750, 1751. For some reason, they don't keep really good records. As the youngest son, though, he can't just stay in Philadelphia and clip coupons. He's sent out to make some money. So he goes to Natchez, which is in what is then West Florida, a British territory, as indeed is Philadelphia in 1770. And he's business partners with Robert Morris, who does not go to Natchez. He stays in Philadelphia. So the store that he opens is Willing and Morris there in Natchez.
Right. And listeners who are not steeped in the Revolutionary War are wondering, who's Robert Morris? And so he was a, spoiler alert, one of the founding fathers. He is one of two guys who has the distinction of signing the big three documents, the Declaration of Independence, the Articles of Confederation, and the Constitution.
And like the, an EGOT for a founding father.
Like an EGOT for a founding father. There's only one other guy who gets to do that. And he is known since he has given a position as essentially the chancellor of the exchequer of the revolution. He's known as the financier of the revolution. So if you want to finance some sort of river warfare, he's the guy to know.
Right. And it's not just the revolution's exchequer. It's a good part of his exchequer that winds up going to the revolution because he was a genuine great man and hero. But, you know, even great men and hero have the occasional dodgy friend. And so Willing, meanwhile, is back in Natchez. War has broken out now, and the British traders have been putting pressure on Willing, and his own, let us say, mediocre skill set has not helped. So he winds up extending credit to a bunch of people who don't pay it back. He runs through his capital, and he returns to Philadelphia bankrupt. And so his immediate thought is, I'll go back to West Florida. I'm going to burn down the houses of everyone who took my money, which is to say he lobbies to lead a military campaign to West Florida. And when you're friends with Robert Morris, you get results. So he gets a captain's commission in the Continental Navy, and he gets orders to Fort Pitt, which is now Pittsburgh. And he buys a bateau, which is a long riverboat. This one is oared like a galley. It has two swivel guns and a little sail and a big sweep for steering. And here is where he shows a flash of humor, and any irritation I have with James Willing melted away when I heard that he named his ship the USS Rattletrap. And I love that guy now.
Yeah, he considered the USS Self-Awareness, but that was a little too much on the nose.
Yeah, well, the trouble is that his self-awareness is not going to keep him afloat. January 10th, 1778, he has fit out the Rattletrap. He's got 34 Marines, and he sails down the Ohio River. Obviously, you know, takes a left at Kaskaskia and goes down the Mississippi. On February 19th, he arrives at the plantation of one Anthony Hutchins, who is the local militia colonel for that part of West Florida, and he grabs him out of his house. And a later British writer says, yes, Willing turned out to raid a number of houses where he had been made a guest in simpler times. I wonder how that worked.
Yeah, he was breaking Zeus's laws of hospitality there.
He certainly was a bit. And when you grab a guy out of his own house and you seize all of his stuff, including his slaves, which is sort of the dark side of this fun river piracy story. He then goes to Natchez, and the town has no garrison and no cannons, and so it swears neutrality to avoid him destroying it. And so he sort of recruits all the pro-American people in Natchez, many of them river pirates, and then he fans out from there and raids loyalist planters all along the Mississippi, and this is where the area brigands sort of, as I mentioned, show up. This becomes a problem for the British, so they send the 14-gun sloop Rebecca. They think 14-2, that seems good, even for the British. They go up the river to stop Willing, but they park their boat at Fort Butte, which is near modern-day Baton Rouge. And while the boat is parked there, his Marines sneak up on it and take it. And so it is now the USS Morris, and now he has 16 guns, and this becomes a situation. So no British possession in the Natchez area or that part of West Florida is safe. By late March of 1778, he has accumulated so much loot that he has to start selling it. He shows up in New Orleans, which is at this time Spanish, and at this time officially neutral, and he starts selling his loot through the congressional agent in the city, a man named Oliver Pollock, who also knew him from the old times.
Right, thus adding a gear up to the beginning of this scenario.
Right. Pollock and Willing, you know, unload the cargoes, as I say, including slaves who have been stolen, captured, whatever, not liberated. That was not what happened from the loyalist plantations. The total loot is estimated at 30,000 pounds, which doesn't sound like a lot. It's about $8 million today. But if you take it as a share of the West Florida GDP, it's enormous. Plus, of course, there's stuff he didn't steal. He just burned down like a bunch of indigo works. So he would go around and burn down any factory or establishment that the British or the loyalists in West Florida had. So this was a very impactful, important raid so far. And the so far, I think, is where a lot of the work is being done. The governor of New Orleans, a man named Bernardo Galvez, he likes the part where people have to fence loot in New Orleans, but he doesn't like the part where the British Navy says, we're going to blockade New Orleans if you don't get rid of this guy. Also, Willing has brought a bad element to New Orleans. They don't like a bunch of river pirates after they've spent all their money. So by July of 1778, Galvez and Pollock, who has to keep living here after Willing leaves, sort of agree to put their foot down. So Pollock doesn't extend Willing any credit for rations or supplies or pay. And he says, you were supposed to steal that. Didn't you get money from all the loot? And Willing says, but the loot is gone. And then Galvez refuses to allow Willing to leave New Orleans, and he runs off the brigands with Spanish troops. And so in August of 1778, he allows the Marines that do not include Willing to take the rattletrap back north through Spanish territory along the Arkansas. And the Marines do a remarkable exfil in that they go through what is basically jungle at that time with no Spanish garrisons or forts, and they make their way up to Kaskaskia in the Illinois Territory, and they rendezvous with Colonel George Rogers Clark, the hero of the West. So from their perspective, this was gigantically successful. They renamed the bateau the USS Willing. They have lost a couple of men in some of these street fights over loyalist plantations, but, you know, basically it's combat operations, and from their perspective, it was good. Plus, they stole a boat, and that's very cool. And so they got pieces of the prize money for capturing the Rebecca, plus now the Morris. So Willing is finally allowed to leave New Orleans, so he gets on a ship for Philadelphia, but the Royal Navy captures him at sea, and he's thrown in prison in New York, possibly as a pirate. So he's sitting in Durrenceville and complaining very strenuously about it. On August 18th, 1779, the USS Morris, which is now under the command of Captain Pickles, sadly of whom not much is known, is destroyed in a hurricane. But by now, also, Galvez is at war with Britain, and so he says, well, I've got a schooner around here that's just as good. Why don't you make that the USS Morris? And also, I'm going to conquer West Florida, since now you've been so nice as to destroy all the British infrastructure there. So the Spanish conquer West Florida. The new USS Morris sweeps the hated British aside in the Battle of Lake Pontchartrain in 1779. So heroic actions. And then in 1781, George Washington says, are the British really holding a naval captain prisoner and no one is doing anything about it? We should exchange a British captain for him. So they do. And so Willing is exchanged and then spends the rest of his life in Philadelphia trying to get Congress to pay him back his share of the loot, the money he was owed that Pollock didn't extend him, reimburse him his own outlays, which he sets at £1,000. And maybe that's true and maybe that's not. or just anything, a pension, any recognition whatsoever. Congress, probably out of incompetence and inanition rather than out of cruelty, doesn't ever get around to giving him any money, as with many, many revolutionary veterans, by the way. And in 1801, Willing dies. And that is the end of the James Willing story and of the West Florida Raid, as it is sometimes called, or Willing's Depredation, which is my favorite name for it.
Yes, a depredation sounds pretty good. Everybody wants a depredation on their resume. Mm-hmm. So I guess we have, first of all, a opening precedent for American veterans getting the shaft as soon as they're no longer necessary. But we also have a whole bunch of adventure hooks. And the most obvious one is that basically in your Nations and Cannons campaign, you basically become the equivalent of Willing. You're the ones who go down and do that mission. And maybe you can avoid his mistakes. Maybe you can work things differently.
Avoid the hurricane.
Yeah. Well, you know, maybe you'll have a resist hurricane saving throw that'll go well. You never know.
Yeah.
Other things is, you know, you are in New Orleans and you're investigating a murder, and many of the suspects are Willing's river pirates who've been cut adrift to cause trouble. What else can we turn into an adventure hook here?
Well, there's various loot objects from Natchez that Willing might have gotten off some loyalist plantation where they were up to no good chicanery of a Hellfire Club type, and their magic book or their sacred idol or their cult fetish object might have been, you know, grabbed and sold in New Orleans, and now it's running around and various New Orleans sorcerers are trying to get their hands on it, maybe to do good with it if they're like good Rada practitioners of Vodun, or maybe to do evil with it if they're filthy Franco Spaniards up to no good, as often they were. So anytime there's loot, there's story items. And then also, I think those Marines going north through basically a incredibly cool wilderness hex crawl, carrying, as I mentioned, the USS Rattletrap when they have to portage from river to river, I think that's a great sort of, it's an escort story, but you have to escort the boat or else you're not going to be able to get out of this hellish southeastern forest that you find yourself trapped in. And maybe not just the Chickasaw are giving you problems, but lots of people are giving you problems. And it could be the giants that DeSoto saw when he was in that neck of the woods. Could be any number of cryptids, could be biting you, skunk apes, who can say? I think that's just a great, you know, set piece story too.
Well, having turned all of this into grist for Nations and Cannons scenarios, we can pronounce this mission complete, but I believe another objective awaits on the other side of this exciting commercial message.
The play The King in Yellow has haunted imaginations like a dirge since its first appearance in 1895.
But among the fortune tellers of Europe, the play was not the fearful beginning of something new, but the culmination of something older, The King in Yellow Tarot.
Daniel Harms and John Scott Tynes, famous clairvoyants, divined the form's importance of this Carcosan deck.
Painter Kurt Komoda, in a fevered fugue of inspiration, reproduced designs thought long lost.
Spread the cards.
Let the King in Yellow tell your fate.
There is no other who could.
After all, you have seen the yellow sign.
The King in Yellow Tarot is a complete deck of 78 cards in full color.
Sturdy cards with a soothing, silky finish.
Inspired by the works of Robert W. Chambers.
An accompanying 28-page guide explores the history of the deck and recommends, hesitantly, its technique.
A complete PDF of cards and guide comes with your order.
Add to cart at shop.arcdream.com.
That's your reality shattered cart at shop.arcdream.com. Save this podcast from river pirates alongside such beloved Patreon backers as
Andy Shockney,
Joe Webb,
Vic Politis,
Coleman Gonzalez,
and Darcy Castleman. It's time once again for Ken and or Robin talk to someone else. And this time around, it's me, Robin, talking to beloved colleague and most mentioned person on this show, who, of course, isn't us, Gareth Ryder Hanrahan, beloved fantasy author and, of course, game designer. And Gar, you are here to talk about Mary Sure Detective Club.
Exactly.
Which is now crowdfunding on BackerKit. So, folks, you can search for it on BackerKit, Merry Shire Detective Club. And full disclosure, I'm the developer on this book, so I know the answer to most of these questions already. Tell me, if I and a bunch of others are playing Merry Sure Detective Club, who are we playing and what are we doing?
You are playing a bunch of halflings or halfling-adjacent creatures like dwarves or boggarts or puka. You all live in a cozy, bucolic, friendly little village, and you are a club of amateur detectives solving crimes, which may be anything from who stole the pies to who murdered the pie maker and everything in between.
And mostly who murdered the pie maker.
Yeah.
So one of the things we've been working to convey is the tone of the game, because, Gar, this is cozy in the previous sense that people thought of the cozy mystery genre, whether we're talking Agatha Christie or Midsummer Murders or Murder, She Wrote, where there's
Murder is pretty much like, you know, not the only crime, but it's the default crime. I mean, the genre was called cozy murders for a long time before it got switched to cozy mysteries, but we're bringing back murder. Murder's cool again.
Right, because there's been a new use of the word cozy, which is to suggest a happy, no-conflict world. But this, in fact, is a funny game, and it's blackly humorous.
Yeah. I mean, the people who get murdered generally either deserve it or are people you care about too much. But yeah, murder is the default crime, certainly.
Right. Because, of course, one of the bedrock assumptions of the genre is that there have to be multiple suspects. And for there to be multiple suspects, at least everyone on the suspect list has to have had a possible reason to kill the victim. Otherwise, you have no mystery if there's only one. I guess you would also have a mystery if everybody loved them and you have to dig deeper under the surface to find out.
But then you dig, and you dig up all sorts of gossip and, like, you know, dark buried secrets and skeletons and closets that the supposedly lovely halfling gentleman who everyone thought was great and who, like, you know, never did anything other than dig up his potatoes and drink wine has some horrible things in his backstory that would give many people motives to off him and bury him in his own potato patch.
So I've been playing this as well and having a great time doing it. And some of the things that I've been running for my group will turn into scenarios for the companion volume that goes with the core book, which is The Dreadful Hair and Other Halfling Mysteries. However, you've written the bulk of these scenarios. Kevin Culp is also doing a couple. Can you preview for us a couple of the premises of the scenarios in Dreadful Hair?
Well, the titular scenario is your classic sort of country house murder mystery. Well, it's more of an arson mystery, where basically you're all called to this house where this family is having this reunion, that's long lost hair has arrived. And in the middle of dinner, someone sets fire at the library, and you've got to investigate who set this fire, why there's a magic rabbit involved, and what's really going on. There's also two corpses in a trench coat, which opens with the player characters finding the top half of two halflings who were wearing a human-sized trench coat and clearly pretending to be a human. And someone has shot the top half in the back and the legs are missing. So you've got to go off and find the legs and find out who's trying to murder him. There's Orc and Pie, where you've got to find a stolen pie, and nothing more grisly happens at all. And I'm currently putting the finishing touches to the Riddleton Reaver, which is this village serial killer story.
So let's dig in a bit to who you play if you're not a halfling. The assumption is most people are playing halflings. And the most accessible, obvious one is the dwarf. So what would a dwarf be doing in a halfling village where nothing happens? Nothing but murder.
The dwarves are your sort of solid, straightforward, serious-minded craftsmen. They're valued by the halflings because they do the serious, complicated work. They're like, you've got the dwarven, like, metalsmiths and so forth. And they also have this power of craft that can basically make low-level magic items for the halflings. And your dwarf might join your club investigators because they're motivated by a sense of order, sense of justice, and also they've got, like, you know, large access to things with.
So people are used to playing halflings and dwarves, but perhaps not the other two types of character, the other two kin. Mm-hmm. So tell us about boggarts. What's the deal with them?
Boggarts sort of bounced around a lot in development. They started out as goblins. We sort of went through various variations on golem-like creatures, and they've ended up in a more interesting place where they're sort of the, not the dark mirror of halflings, but the sort of the slightly weird mirror of halflings. They come from the underwriting, which is the sort of underside of the setting. They're sort of like, you know, sort of like Edgar Allan Poe or Edward Gorey-esque take on halflings. They're more like eccentric and weird and off-putting in a friendly way.
Yes, they're more Tim Burton creations than exactly weird, chaotic bad guys. However, if you want to bring chaos in, as opposed to lovable goofballism, then you turn to the Pooka. What is the Pooka doing in the game and in the writing?
That's an excellent question. Pooka are drawn mainly from Irish myth. They're these shape-shifting spirits of sort of chaos. Saying chaos and vengeance sounds very, very aggressive, but like you certainly, the retribution and, I guess chaos is the best word, probably. So they can take any form they want, but they always have a particular tell. So like your character might appear as a squirrel or a horse or a chair, but you're always wearing, say, a top hat, or you'd always have to speak backwards or have some other sort of distinctive mark. They've got the power of Pooka magic, so they can basically do, again, sort of low-level bits of weirdness. And they're very much sort of the character for the oddball player who doesn't want to be nice and cozy and polite, but wants to have a little bit of strangeness to them.
Now, when I played this game for the first time, you ran it for the Pelgranes, there was a type of character you can play that has now been cut. So why were humans originally playable in Mary Shure, and why are they not now?
I mean, originally we had humans just in as like sort of the generic default in every game as sort of the standard option. And I was going to have, like, keep humans in because I thought like people might want to play them. But their gimmick was basically they're big. And it just, you want the halflings to be the ordinary ones. And taking humans out meant it could make the human kingdoms beyond be more of a sort of general parody of fantasy and go make humans the butt of the joke.
So listeners may have already inferred, but let's be explicit. This is a gumshoe game. Mm-hmm. Gumshoe games always retool their basic elements in order to fit the genre of mystery that they're emulating. In this case, Gar, what elements did you add to gumshoe in order to have detectives detectiving around the halfling writing?
I mean, to a degree, this is sort of the purest gumshoe game we've done because it is like the mysteries are right at the forefront, like in like Trail or something. You've got, if you do like a classic murder mystery and Trail, then behind it all, there is like a secret cult or something. Whereas here, they probably did kill the halfling for the insurance money, or it really is about that old family grudge. So the core gumshoe rules worked absolutely perfectly well for it. I did the normal thing where I tweaked like the names of investigative abilities, added a few like eavesdropping and gossip. But the core, you look at the clue approach to gumshoe, worked perfectly well. I tweaked the combat system, obviously enough, because it's not a genre where fighting and struggles are preeminent. So basically the contest system has been tweaked a little bit. And there's a reputation mechanic, so reflecting your standing in the village, which sort of takes the place of sanity or stability in other games. But it is large, like one of the most sort of straightforward gumshoe adaptations we've done.
And you mentioned that you've added different investigative abilities. The one that everybody loves is bugs and mushrooms. So I'd just like to conclude by asking you to discuss the predominant importance of the bugs and mushrooms ability to the game.
Each of the four kins have their own abilities. So halflings have cousins. So basically it works like contacts in Nightspec agents. If you go, oh, we need like, you know, someone who can like, you know, sneaks into the back door of the manor or who has a fast getaway cart, you can go, aha, I've got a cousin. Pookas of Pooka magic, dwarves of craft, as I said. Bugs and mushrooms is the boggart special ability. The mushrooms part, basically, you can spend a point and you can have a mushroom that will have some strange effect. In pretty much 50% or so of the playtest games I've run, someone has ended up putting soporific mushrooms into the cream pies to basically knock out NPCs.
It's basically Chekhov's mushroom is the principle at work there.
Yeah, exactly. And the bugs part, you can basically get a moth or a spider and plant it as a bugging device and have it listen to people and report back, although the different breeds of bugs have different advantages and drawbacks.
Well, when my players hear this interview, they'll be surprised to learn you can do either of those two things, because they've just used bugs and mushrooms to get information about bugs and mushrooms, which is always vital to every case. So, Garth, thank you so much for joining us for this interview. Everybody head on over to the Backer Kit and get your copies. And we'll have another exciting segment or hut right after this commercial.
The British are coming.
The Kickstarter campaign is almost upon us for Flagbearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated, in Nations and Cannons you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
The next book, The American Crisis, Dark and Bloody Ground, follows the actions of the war in the South and the West with historical adventures, setting information, perfidious new enemies, and a sprawling campaign.
The Kickstarter campaign also features a revised core book supporting play in other eras, a supplement about political scheming within the two sides of the war, and years of maps, supplements, splat books, and adventures following the war from Boston to Yorktown.
Nations and Cannons is 5e compatible and focuses on unconventional heroes from underrepresented perspectives.
This Kickstarter is the best time ever to get into Nations and Cannons.
Sign up to be notified of the Kickstarter campaign at yourdadwilllovethis.com. It's time to wander now into the most ill-defined of huts, one where we're never really sure at first what's going on, because in one corner, we've got a guy writing a crank history. His ears are very perked up this time around. And then there's a strange map with some sort of pyramid situation going on. And, oh, wait, when we look out the window, we can gaze at the alien big cat. He's screaming out on the moor. Over in the corner are, I think this time around, a pretty blasé Nordic and gray alien. They're just going to drink their kombucha and roll their lidless eyes, in the case of the gray alien, at human folly, because we're going to look at a new prophet has arisen. He's making the rounds sort of, not in the real news, but in the kind of sub-news that has appeared as news-like stories that have come in to fill the gap now that all real newspapers are paywalled. And there's been a search for not information, but content. And someone who's showing up a lot in the content is Zhang Shuoqin, a psychohistorian and the person supposedly now known as the Chinese Nostradamus. He, in fact, predicted that he would become known as the Chinese Nostradamus, and he has been. So there's a prediction down for you right there. So, Ken, the story that you see in the sub-news is a little bit rosy, a little bit vague. So I assigned you to turn over some rocks. What did you find?
Well, bugs and slime, because that's what happens when you turn over rocks. This guy, born in Guangdong in 1976, as the Cultural Revolution is tapering off, his family is able to emigrate to Canada. So this is Canadian content, Canadian Elliptony Hut. I hope everyone is happy. In 1982, he has a very bad childhood in that his dad, who was a respected teacher before the Cultural Revolution, doesn't know any English, and he has to get a job as a short order cook, and it's just a sad situation, and he dresses badly and everyone throws rocks at him. And so, of course, he goes to Yale, basically lies his way into Yale, graduates in 1999 with a BA in English, does not also have a good time in Yale. At Yale, he has the insight, and this is part of his brilliant mind, that who you know is more important than what you know. And I don't think you have to go to Yale to get that, but I guess Yale's a good place to get that information.
But many people do go to Yale to meet. That's where smart guys go to meet dumb guys. So
exactly. Well, whichever kind of guy he was, he didn't meet anyone at Yale because he failed to get a bunch of journalist gigs. He spent like a year as Gay Talese's Chinese interpreter, and that didn't turn into anything. By 2001, he has basically been rejected by the New Yorker, rejected by everyone he tried to get gigs with, South China Morning Post, etc. So he's working for PBS, and the word working for PBS means PBS has offered him a pittance to do a documentary that they will maybe air. And this is an undercover documentary about the Chinese labor movement. And he is caught filming a strike and a protest by the Communist Party police. And they imprison him. And then he's deported to Canada in 2002 because he's a Canadian citizen. So you think, well, that's the end of his career in China. I guess he does everything. Nope. All is forgiven. He comes back in 2003 and becomes an educational reform theorist. And this
is
where...
It's not what you know, it's who you know.
It's who you know. And maybe who you know is the guy who had you in his interrogation room saying, we have a list of all your relatives in China and we have your fingernails. So would you like to work for us forever? And this is where my ears prick up at this part of his resume. Anyway, he goes back and he works at various high schools. He does not even get a job at a college. Even the CCP is not that interested in this guy, but they're high profile high schools. They're technical high schools and high schools where basically the school is a way to cram to get Chinese students admitted to American universities. But at Shenzhen, at the Tsinghua University affiliate high school, etc. And this lasts until about 2014 when someone that I read suggests that Xi Jinping purged Yalies, which, again, talk about your Xi Jinping thought, but he purges people with those sorts of American connections from official positions. But, you know, nothing lasts forever. He claws his way back and gets a job in 2022 as a history teacher at a small Beijing private school named Moonshot Academy, which is, you know, an open campus Montessori type school. And that's ages 8 to 18. Idyllic, no doubt, not least because your professors are insane and unqualified. And he starts his YouTube channel the next year, 23. It's called Predictive History. And he is your host, Professor Zhang. And remember, he is not actually a professor. And the format of the channel is he does a pretend classroom lecture. He's in an academic coat. He's in front of a whiteboard. He's doing his lectures in English. There is a audience of students. Are they shills? Are they his real students getting extra credit? Who can say? And his argument is that the lectures he does on his channel are based on geopolitical game theory, structural analysis, and psychohistory, as in the famous historian Isaac Asimov's novels.
Right. Now, it's been a while since I've read those, the Foundation series in high school. I've forgotten. Do we want psychohistory? Or is it a torment nexus that we should not create?
Knowing the future, I think, is technically a torment nexus, especially if the future looks like the present or the past. But because it is secret and kept far away and has no impact on the immediate governing of the empire, I think it's a too soon to say type situation. But it is, according to most historians, and I want to give a one cheer for psychohistory, there are large patterns in history. You can analyze them. There are rules of what people who don't want to be called psychohistorians often call cleology. And we could do a whole segment on that someday. But it is certainly a minority belief that this is even a real possible thing, much less that we can do it now. So just put a pin in that. But this is far from the worst thing that this guy does. Anyway, 2024, here's a episode called The Iran Trap, which is a episode that later becomes very famous because in that he predicts that Trump will be reelected. Haters say at that time, the Kalshi production site also predicted Trump would be reelected.
He was ahead for most of 2024.
He predicted a renewed US-Iran conflict, which I think would fall out of predicting Trump being reelected because Trump was not shy about conflicting with Iran in term one. Certainly Iran is not, you know, straightened up and flown right since then. So there we are. And he predicts a defeat for the United States by Iran that will reshape the world order. And this is what has got, I think, some of his juice in that people who oppose the war for whatever reason like to say, look, it's not just me. The Chinese Nostradamus says it's a bad idea. Look at him. So in 2026, the war actually breaks out and his subscriber count on YouTube is now almost 2 million. And he's got a Substack that has another million people or maybe the same million people. But, you know, we laugh, we mock, but real journalists, real people of integrity, such as Piers Morgan and Tucker Carlson have had this guy on their show. So yeah, clearly he's not a nut. And in case you were worried about the psychohistory and that that was not a particularly strong read on which to rest predictions, he does note that he is also accessing a higher force. So
he did want to be in the Elliptony hut, not just in conspiracy corners.
So just wanted to be in the Elliptony hut. Yeah. And so the higher force has given him many insights. Among the sort of high notes include the Second Punic War didn't exist, which, frankly, my favorite one of his insights was just a scam created by Polybius to justify the Third Punic War, which I guess would be the actual Second Punic War.
Yes. It was all a multi-level marketing scheme.
Exactly. It's Punic Wars all the way down. Big archaeology is hiding the truth at Göbekli Tepe, the primordial, probably religious and ceremonial site in Turkey. And they're doing it to prevent a world-changing revelation, such as all the pole shifts and global floods that have totally happened. He doesn't say evolution isn't real, but he does say, if evolution is real, why don't we all have six fingers and three eyes? Evolutionists can't answer that question, can they? The pyramids are power plants. That's old news. Everyone knows this. But the pharaohs were tortured into psychopathy by the priesthood, which I think is a cool alternate theory to go with someday, but does not seem to have any basis in archaeology.
Might be a little allegory of the CPC there.
Yes, the best name in archaeology, Flint Dibble, has sort of done debunkings on this stuff and says, you're talking nonsense. Stop talking nonsense. He says Trump is trying to live forever by harnessing attention. So is he trying to become an egregore from episode 511? No one can say, but harnessing attention. I mean, he's got half of this story, certainly.
Yeah.
The film One Battle After Another was a psyop to ignite civil war in America. So not, I guess, a PTA fan. He's just asking questions about the moon landing and just asking questions about Hitler. And there's no concrete evidence for the Holocaust. And when Iran defeats America, all the American companies will relocate to Jerusalem. And everyone's like, oh, all right, here we are.
Okay, yes. So he's once again proving your axiom.
Exactly.
Any conspiracy theory or craziness left to sit and fester on its own will eventually devolve into anti-Semitism.
Yes, his specific belief strain is that the Sabbateans, which were a messianic Jewish cult of the 17th and 18th century, secretly run the world and also invented Marx, that Marx was secretly a Sabbatean, and their tools, the Jesuits and the Templars and the Illuminati and whatnot, are all getting it done even as we speak. And so they're planning their horrible apocalyptic messiah to show up and mess everyone up, because that's just what Sabbateans do, just asking questions. And, you know, even Tucker Carlson pushes back a little bit on this. He's like, doesn't this sound anti-Semitic? And he says, hey, 5 years ago, I would have agreed with you. It's like, okay. Great answer, Zhang. What a guy. Certainly the Chinese Nostradamus. And when you're more anti-Semitic than a 16th century Frenchman, I feel like you're really accomplishing something. But he's got a YouTube channel, and I guess that's right. All we need to say.
That speed runs you to your anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. So, first of all, listeners, if you're hanging out at a bar and some incredulous brings up the Chinese Nostradamus, Zhang Xuanchen, you now have the ammunition to look askance at them. And once again, we've proven that anyone marketing themselves as a prophet is waving a red flag and someone to be wary about. And so definitely this is the kind of person who will show up in an esoterrorist campaign. They're trying to crack rationality in a nutcracker made of apparent rationality, that once you lift the rock, you find out it's, you know, all this same old stuff.
Yep.
Or possibly this is someone who's experiencing or presaging a reality shift, and your fictionalized version of this person has maybe read a little bit of a certain play that was running around Paris in 1895.
Yeah, I like the idea that that there is some wing of the Chinese Ministry of State Security that has stumbled on the esoterrorists and is weaponizing them. Obviously, there's a good part of the Chinese police that's the Chinese part of Ordo Veritas, but, you know, our cops don't know everything the CIA is doing, so I assume that the MSS has their little esoterror wing, and they've launched this guy as their sort of first big wave, and now they're like, oh, well, that worked really well, so now the time for the faceless clown videos and whatever else.
Yeah.
So that's
I think
fun...
the Ordo has very limited contacts in different authoritarian structures, so they're,
yes, right,
they're in the minority, and it's the... They have to look out in the halls for the people who know about the Outer Dark.
But it would make an interesting campaign for your Ordo group if they're based in America, or as you say, based in any democratic country, that the bad guy is, first of all, doesn't even believe in esoteric. They're just using it as a weapon stupidly. And second of all, they're unreachable by you unless you maybe adopt the weapons of the enemy, scratch chin. So that, I think, could be a fun overarching story. And this guy can be sort of a proof of concept that you then riff on when you have the even crazier stuff on the deep Chinese YouTube. On the deep, I don't know what Chinese YouTube is called, but they have one. On TikTok, that's Chinese YouTube. So, yeah.
Well, having proven another concept, and I would say we've proven many, many concepts over the course of this episode, we can pat ourselves on the back for another job well done and prepare to be back a mere week from today when, Ken, you will sound just a little bit echoey because you'll be at Gen Con.
Yes.
You'll be in a hotel room with probably with air conditioning you can't shut off. But until we get to that point, everybody enjoy their week, and we'll be back a mere week from today. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Paul Grain Press.
Arc Dream.
Flag Bearer Games.
Dork Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/KenAndRobin.
Protect the sanctity of this podcast's second breakfast alongside such backers as...
Michael Curtis.
Mike Merles.
Oli Toivonen.
Peter Williamson.
And Scott Jones.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Celebrate your joy of missing out with our latest design, Jomo.
On Axe, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindlaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when once again we will talk about stuff.